Joy must sing in the night to face change unafraid. This is the essence of spiritual development, that we need to be able to have that centeredness within ourselves and that level of inner joy that even if changes occur, the ups and downs of life, the joys and sorrows of life, the successes and failures, the fulfillments and disappointments, that none of these touch us. We can face them unafraid because we know that we have reality within ourselves, an unshakable joy and calmness. This is the subject, then, of our talk today, the soul's voyage from bondage to freedom. And the first chapter is on the law of karma. Life's laws are one and the same on every level. The laws of physics are not essentially different from the laws of spirit. There are, of course, differences in manifestation. There are differences of degree. Nevertheless, and karma is a very good example of this, that the law of karma is the same thing as the law of motion, the Newtonian law of motion in the realm of physics. And we find the principles of inertia, of movement, the same, whether in psychological activity, whether in spiritual activity. There is one central rule that guides everything. The only exception that I can think of at the moment, and probably it can be resolved, is that thought doesn't seem to diminish with space. In other words, somebody could have a thought in India or have the same thought in the next room, and if you're sensitive, you'd get it equally powerfully. It seems not to obey the law of physics that says that light, for example, diminishes with distance. Thought doesn't diminish. But on the other hand, thought is behind, you might say, the realm of space and time. It's closer to that level of consciousness where everything is here and now. That may be the answer. Nevertheless, if you will study spiritual teachings, you'll be surprised to see how many of them apply to the world around you. And this is helpful in the sense that as you come to understand the world around you with open eyes spiritually, you can begin to understand subtler laws that otherwise, at least in books, one finds the strangest and I might say silliest kinds of ideas of philosophical conundrums. People can spin all kinds of imaginations until they bring them down to the bedrock of fact, of reality. And so I've often said that dogmatism increases in direct proportion to one's inability to prove a point. If there's a chance that you could prove what you're saying, then you're going to be less dogmatic and more tentative. But if there's no hope, then you can be fanatical. So it's good always to bring whatever... I read a passage of Dane Rudyar once, and he may or may not have been a great astrologer. I just don't know. But I did try to read it, and I came, unfortunately, immediately upon a passage that was far too deep for me, I'll tell you. One whole paragraph, about 12 lines, and I couldn't make head nor tail of it. And yet I imagine that people would say, oh, this is deep. Why? Because they don't understand it. Well, what I found in writing is that until I can bring a thing down to a concrete example, I'm not sure I've understood it well. I certainly can't explain it well. You need to take these beautiful thoughts and bring them down to a level where you can say, yes, I've experienced that up to a certain point. And so, even such principles as love, we find it expressed in gravity. We find it expressed in the magnetism that draws a compass to point to the pole, and so on. So, Master, on this subject, we're going to be talking about karma, and a visitor asked him, "The Bible says that evildoers shall be punished and the good rewarded. Do you subscribe to this teaching? Paramahansa Yogananda, certainly. If we accept the principle of cause and effect in nature, and of action and reaction in physics, how can we not believe that this natural law extends also to human beings? Do not humans too belong to the natural order? This is the law of karma. As you sow, so shall you reap. This is what St. Paul said. If you sow evil, you will reap evil in the form of suffering. And if you sow goodness, you will reap goodness in the form of inner joy. The visitor, how specific is the law? In physics, the law of motion states that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. In nature, effects are often very specifically and not only vaguely related to their causes. Yet we've been taught to view reward and punishment for human behavior in more general terms. If we're good, we've been told, we'll go to heaven, and if we're bad, we'll go to hell. But people don't think of themselves as reaping specific consequences for specific deeds. Yogananda, the karmic law is exact. There is, furthermore, no question of suffering in hell for eternity. How could the misdeeds of a few years on earth deserve eternal punishment? Could a finite cause have an infinite effect? To understand karma, you must realize that thoughts are things. The very universe, in the final analysis, is composed not of matter, but of consciousness. Matter responds, far more than most people realize, to the power of thought. For willpower directs energy, and energy in turn acts upon matter. Matter, indeed, is energy. The stronger the will, the greater the force of energy, and the greater, consequently, the energy's impact on material events. A strong will, especially if combined with awareness of the cosmic energy, can effect miracles. It can cure diseases and make a person well. It can ensure success in any undertaking. The very seasons are obedient to the man of strong willpower and of deep faith. Even unenlightened human beings shape their destinies more than they themselves realize, according to the way they use their power of will. For no action is ever an isolated event. Always it invites from the universe a reaction that corresponds exactly to the type and the force of the energy behind the deed. Action originates in the will, which directs energy toward its desired end. This, then, is the definition of willpower: desire plus energy directed toward fulfillment. Energy, like electricity, generates a magnetic field, and that magnetic field attracts to itself the consequences of action. The binding force between human action and cosmic reaction is the ego. The consciousness of ego ensures that a person's actions will have personal consequences for himself. These consequences may be delayed if the willpower engendering a thought or deed was not powerful enough to have immediate results, or if its thrust was thwarted by other conflicting energies. Sooner or later, however, every action, whether of body, of thought, or of desire, must reap its final reaction. It is like a circle completing itself. Thus man, made as he is in the image of God, becomes in his turn a creator. The results of good and bad deeds are not experienced only after death. Heaven and hell are realities even here on earth, where people reap the painful consequences of their folly and the harmonious results of right action. People seldom think of their own actions as bad. Whatever they do seems, to them at least, well-intentioned. But if they create disharmony for others, and thus on deeper levels of their being for themselves, those waves of disharmony will inevitably return to them in the form of disharmony. Every action, every thought, reaps its own corresponding rewards. Human suffering is not a sign of God's anger with mankind. It is a sign, rather, of man's ignorance of the divine law. The law is forever infallible in its workings. So you see, karma is action. Any kind of action. It can be the it can be just physical action. The movement of an object will displace some other object. The movement of a wave will cause another wave to go down, and in time it too will have to come down. It's just the constant ebb and flow of life. And this is not only an individual thing. There's such a thing as family karma. You'll see that some families somehow attract the same basic kinds of destiny. There's community karma. There is national karma. Mass karma is a consequence of a mass of people all acting in a certain way and feeling we are doing so and so, and therefore that comes back to them. Sometimes individual karma is enacted on a mass level. For example, each individual who dies in, let's say, the collapse of an elevator. This was an interesting experience that Edgar Cayce had. He was in a department store and was just about to get into the elevator when he stepped back in surprise and the door closed, the cable broke and everybody crashed to his death. And he asked himself later, why did I step back? And he said it was because he realized it was because he was accustomed to seeing people's auras, and these people had no auras. That is to say, every one of them, although they came together individually, they all had that karma and to die at that moment, and so their auras had already begun to withdraw. Their energy had already begun to withdraw from the body. This is the mercy of many deaths, that people are already partly gone before the actual moment. Master was asked this question once. Master, is karma only individual, or does it affect also groups of people? Yogananda, karma is action, simply, whether physical or mental, whether individual or performed by a group, a nation, or a group of nations. Disciple, to what extent is an individual influenced by mass karma? This is a very interesting and an important answer. Yogananda, it all depends on the strength of his individual karma. In an air crash, for example, it needn't be that all who died in it had the karma to do so. The karma of the majority in that disaster may simply have been stronger than that of the minority to live. So sometimes, because karma is a very mechanical thing, really, it's on a subtle level, but its function is mechanical. And you might be in an airplane without a strong enough karma to live, and therefore go with the crash simply because everybody else in the plane had that karma, and you were unlucky enough to be caught in it. On the other hand, something else may happen, and I'll read this first. Those, however, with strong enough karma to live would be saved, either during the crash itself or from taking that flight in the first place. And you remember that crash of the DC-10 outside of Chicago a few years ago? The mother of one of our members was to come, as it turned out, on that plane. And just shortly before she left, her daughter phoned and suggested that she not come so soon. And as a result, she canceled her reservation. Well, that's the sort of thing that happens. In Hiroshima, when they dropped the bomb, it happened that many people, for reasons unaccountable, were invited urgently out of town by relatives they hadn't seen for years. Things happened to make them not present on the scene, evidently because it was their karma not to die. But does it mean that everybody who died on that occasion had the karma to die? No. It simply means they didn't have a strong enough karma to offset that particular negative experience. That's why it's a good thing always to pray before you make a trip, before you go out, in the car or whatever it might be. Pray and put your life and safety in God's hands. Master goes on to say, the karma of a nation depends on the degree to which its people as a whole have acted in keeping with cosmic law. I have often said that America cannot lose in the long run if her enemies attack her, because her karma is basically very good, despite a few wrong things she has done. The karma of her present enemies, by contrast, is bad and they shall have to pay for it. Even animals create karma. Their consciousness, however, including their consciousness of ego, is weak. Thus they are directed rather by mass than by individual karma. It seems unfair, a disciple lamented, that we should be punished for mistakes that we made unintentionally without realizing they were wrong. But you see, the law is impersonal, as mechanics are. It's completely impersonal. And so you have to change that, and we can change it for others by prayer, by right action toward them, by loving them in God, etc. But the karmic law is simply there. You go with it, and it helps you. You go against it, and you hurt yourself by going against it in the same way that you hurt your hand when you place it on a hot stove. The stove had no will to injure you. Rather, the sensitivity in your hand that would be aware of that heat was given to protect you. And that sensitivity can be exaggerated to the point of actual pain if you go too far. But the stove is impersonal, and so also is the law. Ignorance, replied the master, doesn't alter the law. If a person drives his car absent-mindedly into a tree, his resulting injuries won't be fewer because he was absent-minded. You must learn to adapt your actions to the law. As Sri Yukteswarji remarked once to me, the cosmos would be fairly chaotic if its laws could not operate without the sanction of human belief. The law of karma, Master said, is inextricable from its companion, the law of reincarnation. Each would be incomplete without the other. This is so because we see that many people's actions don't reap immediate results. In fact, there's a very interesting story in Autobiography of a Yogi. You remember Trilanga Swami, this saint who had lived 300 years and seemed to have added a pound for every year of his life. He weighed 300 pounds. Anyway, he was a man of great spiritual power. One day a skeptic came to him, pretending to be a devotee, and brought a pail of lime. It looked like milk. And he said, Master, I brought a pail of clabbered milk for you to drink. And Trilanga Swami had a capacious stomach as well as body. And so he took this pail and drank the whole thing. And the disciple was waiting to show that this was just a fraud, when suddenly he fell over screaming with pain. And Trilanga Swami then touched him and healed him. And he said, now that you've learned the divine meaning of boomerang, don't ever try to hurt another person again. Now, Master's very interesting comment after that was to say that saints will often allow karma to work to have its results immediately, rather than be delayed by what he called the thwarting cross currents of ego. You have so many desires that you've set energy off here, and because your heart is confused enough to go off in other directions too, you block that energy from coming back to you soon, and it may not come immediately. Even when you want something, it may not come immediately. You may work hard for something and fail anyway, because you had other kind of karma to create that failure. But sooner or later, that result, good or bad or indifferent, because most karma you can't really call it good or bad, it's just indifferent. Things that happen, like somebody said to a saint in Howrah, can you really tell on the basis of karma what's going to happen to me today? And the saint said, yes, indeed. As you leave here, you will see an accident on the street, and shortly thereafter you will pass a house that's burning down. And neither of these really touched him. They weren't good or bad, they were just neutral. And so the man left, and as he drove out, he saw an accident take place, and he drove a little bit further. He saw fire engines before a house that was on fire. And so all of the things that happened to you, I found a book in India, supposedly written by an ancient sage called Bhrigu, but it may well have been written on the basis of the astrological science that he developed. Anyway, It was written a long time ago, for sure. And I found my name in this book. I found the hour that I would come. I found things that would happen in the future that have since taken place, specific things. I found that it said that he was born in Romania and grew up in America. His father named him James. Well, my full name is James Donald Walters, but I always was called Donald because there were many Jameses in the neighborhood where I lived as a child. So nobody really knew that my name was James. Many things he said that even I didn't know, some of which I didn't know, and that I was able to verify with my family later, my parents. And this was written long ago. Even trivial things, how could it be known then? Because the web of karma is so complex that it really guides to a great extent the shirt you wore this morning, the position you've assumed in this audience today, things of that nature. And yet, we find that many of the things for which we work with great sincerity don't take place, even in this lifetime. Or we find, on the other side of it, mafiosi, for example, who die peacefully in their bed after murdering hundreds, maybe. There doesn't seem to be any justice, and there wouldn't be if it weren't for the law of reincarnation. The same is true for the way we come into this world. Some people are born with every opportunity. Others are born with no opportunity at all. Some people with a minimum of effort suddenly are thrust to success, and other people, no matter how hard they work, always fail. All of this is guided by actions of the past. Some of them are mass karma, some of them are karma of your family, but by and large, they are the karma that you have generated through your own actions, and those are more like mirror reflections of what you've already set into effect yourself. And so this law of karma wouldn't be complete without its companion law, as Master called it, the law of reincarnation. So let's talk about the law of reincarnation now. This chapter is called The Lesson of Reincarnation. Paramahansa Yogananda said, "Why is a baby born crippled? Only reincarnation can explain this fact satisfactorily. People behold it as a sweet, innocent baby, but in some past life that personality must have transgressed against God's law. This transgression deprived him..." Now listen to this, because it's deep and really wonderful. "This transgression deprived him of the consciousness of having good legs. Thus, and because the mind controls the body, when that person came back again into a physical body, he wasn't able to create a perfect pair of legs and was born crippled." It begins in our consciousness. The karmic seeds they lie buried in the subconscious at different levels of the spine according to the different levels of purity. The most material karma is more at the base of the spine. More spiritual karma is more up here in the upper centers. And this is what meditation accomplishes. This is what Kriya Yoga does. It gradually loosens that karma and lifts it up to the brain where it becomes burned up. And it's something that you can't do with individual things. Many people think, well, if I can just learn this particular lesson, I'll be free. Well, it doesn't come that easily. There are millions of lessons to be learned. This may be the one you're conscious of right now. That's why I said yesterday, be grateful when you see a fault. You've got a million others. You might as well get started now. And so, but you can't overcome each one. It's an impossible task. So Master shows us how to do it, and I'll get into that later. The point is, however, that these karmas have to be, these seeds of action have to be released. And until they are, they will be little vortices of conscious energy. That thought, I, tied to the thought, want. This, I want this, I want this. And it creates a vortex. That's why the definition of yoga is the neutralization of these vortices of consciousness. And each vortex is like a seed in the sense that once it becomes liberated, then that is to say, that energy becomes freed to move up to the brain. then it manifests itself the way a seed does that sprouts. And so you will sometimes, and this is the odd thing about human life, you'll encounter some person, some situation, and suddenly that's it for you. Yogananda had a disciple, really he was the son of a disciple and the brother of some disciples, but he wasn't a disciple himself. Still, he was a child and Master tried to help him, but every time he tried to help him, this boy would say to his mother, "Mama, he's scolding me." And finally, Master just gave up. He thought, what's the use of trying to help somebody who doesn't want to be helped? And then he gave him a little model airplane. And immediately the boy, it just clicked for him. This was it. And he went on to become an aeronautical engineer, and his whole life was dedicated to airplanes. But just that sudden thing, and that's possibly happened to you in your life, that some little thing happens and suddenly, well, that's what happens with karma, is that it's lying there latent, waiting for the right soil in which to germinate. And the right soil is those circumstances which are compatible with it. If you want to be an architect and you're reincarnated in a place like Bali where all they have is straw huts, you won't have that desire manifested. But you might somehow see a photograph or see one of those new hotels they've got on Sanur Beach in Bali, and suddenly you think, oh, wow, that's what I want. That's how it works. That's the compatible soil that raises that particular tendency to the brain. And some of these tendencies are good and some of them aren't good. You meet some people and instantly there's an antipathy. You don't know why, but you don't like them. There was there were two monks at Mount Washington who suddenly felt an antipathy for one another. And being monks and being on the path, they worked to overcome it. And then one of them asked Master later, why did we feel that? Master said, it's because you were enemies in a former life. And you've carried over that antipathy into this one. So remember, the things that hit you suddenly, don't think that this is suddenly divine guidance telling you what you've got to do with your life. It may just be a karmic thing coming out. Watch yourself carefully and always be somewhat detached so that you can refer these things up to the infinite. But if these seeds can be brought up through Kriya Yoga in meditation, because this is what Kriya Yoga does, and the brain is calm, concentrated, there's no soil there in which that seed can germinate, to put it metaphorically, then it just dies. And so through Kriya Yoga you gradually can work out the seeds of many, many such karmas in even one meditation. Master said, why is one person born a moron and another intelligent? God would be very unjust, wouldn't he, if he allowed such things to happen without a cause? But there is a cause, for what we are now is the result of our own actions at various times in the past. In our souls we are immortal, but in our personalities we cannot reclaim the consciousness of that immortality until our human imperfections have all been rubbed away. Working on ourselves is like chipping and polishing away the extraneous stone on a statue until the image that was hidden is revealed in all its perfection. There's a cute story that's told in India about a sculptor who did a beautiful image in stone of an elephant. And somebody said, well, how did you do it so well? And the sculptor said, well, I took the stone and I just cut away everything that didn't look like an elephant. Well, that's what we need to do with all these things that are not ourself, our true self. We need to chip away gradually until all that remains is that pure image of the divine within ourselves. One of the things that we need to remember is that this physical body is not the only body cloaking our soul. The way Master described it was that the soul is encased in three bottles, one inside the other. You break the outer bottle, there's still two more bottles to be broken. And so the inmost bottle is the causal body, that idea that forms the other bodies. The middle bottle is the astral body, the energy that is manifested from those ideas. And then the outer bottle is the physical body, that body which is the condensation of that energy. So when you die physically, you still have these other two bottles to contend with. So it's from that thought that Master answered this question. A newcomer to the teachings asked, why must we reincarnate? If we all came from God, then after death, why don't we simply merge back into Him? Paramhansa Yogananda, if our individuality were dissolved by death, we would do so indeed. But the ego forms the physical body. It is the cause, not the effect, of physical birth. The ego is an element of the astral body which is retained after physical death. The physical body is merely the ego's projection into the material world. God cannot be attained by so simple an act as merely dying. To die is easy, but it is very difficult to attain that high level of consciousness in which the soul can merge back into infinity. What indeed would worldly people do if they found themselves confronted with such a possibility? What would they do, for that matter, even in heaven? They would complain about everything and go on arguing and fighting among themselves just as they did on earth. And in the process, they'd only turn heaven itself into another kind of hell. After death, the basic tendencies of a person's nature remain just what they were on earth. Al Capone, the gangster, didn't suddenly become an angel by departing this plane of existence. Criminals retain their evil tendencies until they themselves work them out, perhaps after incarnations and after many hard lessons, until their avarice, for example, has been transformed into a desire to help others, their lawlessness into a desire to uphold the law, and their cruelty into kindness to all. Newcomer, what causes the ego to reincarnate? Yogananda, desire. Desire, you see, directs energy. As long as a person desires the things of earth, he must come back here, where alone his desires can be fulfilled. If he longs for cigarettes, or motor cars, or money, the astral world can't provide those things. He will have to return to earth, where such things can be obtained. A disciple, must every desire conceived on earth be fulfilled here also? Yogananda, not pure desires. Not, for example, the longing for beautiful music, expansive scenery, or harmonious relationships. Such desires can be fulfilled better in the astral world than on this imperfect material plane. In many cases, the desire to create beauty here on earth is due to deeper than conscious memories of the beauty and harmony one experienced in the astral world. To be conscious of subtle realities, we must become subtle in our own perceptions. That's why people, when they die, aren't even capable of seeing the astral world in all its beauty, because they haven't developed that degree of sensitivity themselves. Yogananda told the story, amusing story, of one time he was visiting Lake Chapala, is that how they pronounce it, in Mexico. And he was standing there with an engineer, and they were both standing just completely rapt, gazing at this lake. Yogananda was thinking, God is so beautiful, look at this wonderful scenery that he's created. And he thought that this man must be thinking the same thing when the man suddenly said, just think of all the power you could get out of this much water. So we see what we are. We see what we have in our own minds. And if our perceptions are dull, don't think that by dying you're suddenly going to be aware of beautiful regions. This comes by hard work, by meditation, by good deeds, but certainly not just by dying. A visitor asked the question, how much does the soul experience of its life in the astral world? Does it remain there for many years after leaving the physical plane? The Master, it depends on your degree of spiritual evolution. Materialistic souls, I use the word soul here in the sense you have, though in fact the soul is ever perfect. It is ego consciousness that one carries with him into the astral world. Materialistic souls, then, are so hypnotized by what they think of as matter's reality that they are not sensitive to subtler realms of existence. Such persons after death fall into a deep sleep. If they wake up at all later on, they may find themselves surrounded by darkness or by a kind of gray mist. They don't know where they are. If on earth they lived evil lives, they may suffer nightmares and be tormented by demons. After some time, they are reborn in a new body to continue the long climb toward spiritual enlightenment. Those with more spiritual tendencies, on the other hand, develop through their virtuous deeds and inclinations a degree of intuition. They are therefore more sensitive to that other world after death, and are able more consciously to enjoy its beauty. Having raised their own vibrations by good deeds, they are attracted to higher vibrations in the astral realm. Those souls especially who in this life have meditated, even a little bit, go to regions of great beauty after death. Those also go to higher regions who have prized duty and truth above their physical existence. A visitor asked, "Do even soldiers, then, who die in battle, go to heaven?" The Master, "If they died for duty and truth." In other words, if they died with noble aims and not just out of the desire to kill. Visitor, "What is heaven like?" The Master, "There are two kinds of heaven. The one most people think of is that which comprises the higher regions of the astral world. The true heaven, however, is the one which Jesus, and the one to which Jesus more often referred, is the state of union with God. The astral heaven has, as Jesus described it, many mansions or levels of vibration. It is similar to this material world, for this one is a projection of those subtler realms. The astral heaven, however, is without the countless imperfections of this grosser plane of existence. Heaven is not up there, as people commonly imagine. It is all around us. It is just behind our physical vision. I see it all the time, and I spend much of my time there. It is a vast universe composed of beautiful lights, sounds, and colors. The colors of the material plane are very dull by comparison. Heaven's beauty is like the most radiant sunset you have ever seen, and even far more beautiful. I know an Italian lady who is very saintly and has always, since childhood, had a vision of what was going on the other side. And she's always seeing people. We're surrounded by people all the time. But sometimes somebody will come to her door and knock, and she's been known to open the door and say, "Are you alive or dead?" They look so much the same to her. Yogananda told me once about a disciple who had died, and he wasn't really a disciple, he was a student, but he died with an attraction for this path. And Master said later, just about a week later, he said, "He's feeling that attraction. I've been seeing him around here these days." Another interesting thing he said, and I want you to keep this in mind, this man who died, he was an old man, and I visited him on his deathbed, and he was saying, "Oh, I've done so many wrong things in my life." And I told Master this later. Master looked very sad. He shook his head. He said, "He shouldn't have said that." In other words, don't carry with you the thought of the wrong that you've done. You'll be attracted to that. Whereas if you can always cling to the thought that no matter how many times you err, no matter how many times you fall, you are a child of God, and die with that consciousness, then you'll be lifted up much more easily to higher planes of existence. Master said there is infinite variety in the astral world. The seasons there can be changed at will by advanced souls. Usually it is springtime there with perennial sunshine. Snow, when it falls, is peaceful and beautiful and not at all cold. When the rain falls, it descends gently as myriad-colored lights. Sentiments, too, are highly refined on the astral plane, and far more intense than people normally experience them on earth. Heaven is not an idle place. Its inhabitants are very active. All the vibrations of this material universe are controlled by angels. Astral beings, though busy, are at the same time very happy. Sometimes, in their compassion for mankind, they visit people in dreams or in visions, or inspire in them beautiful thoughts. How long a person remains in the astral world depends on how well he lived on earth. Those with good karma may remain there for many centuries. Devotees, on the other hand, spurred on by their desire for enlightenment, may elect to return to earth sooner in order to continue their spiritual efforts, for they realize that the astral world, too, is but a veil behind which the Lord hides his face of eternal perfection. The thing is that the astral world, unless a person is already very highly advanced, it's difficult, if not impossible, to progress spiritually there. It's too beautiful. I'm talking of the higher worlds. It's too beautiful. You feel everything you ever wanted. You're drawn to a planet where the people are like you in tastes and temperament, and you feel a degree of harmony that's completely lacking here on Earth. It's not that you're less conscious, but you're so fulfilled that the incentive is lacking. There's a story about a saint in India who was always very serviceful. No matter what happened, he would always help somebody, help people out. One day, when he was very hungry himself, somebody came to the door, and this was a saint who had come to test him and asked to be fed. The saint had just sat down with his meal to eat, and he immediately gave it to this other saint. And the saint looked at it, he said, "That's terrible." He threw it on the ground where it would be impossible to eat, and then asked him that he make another meal. And the saint lovingly made another meal, and the other one threw it on the ground again. And so the third time he made it, and the same thing happened, the saint who had cooked the meal remained completely peaceful, said, "I'll just make you another, never mind, I'll try better." And this saint who had visited him finally said, "You have really passed all my tests. You have become so noble in your nature that it's really right, and it's your karmic reward. And in fact, I was sent here to give this to you, to be transported to heaven, even in your own physical body," which is a way they have of saying, meaning that you don't lose consciousness at the time of death when you go into the astral world. So you don't lose the feeling of having a body, you just take on the astral body. Obviously, the physical body can't walk the streets of heaven, it would fall right through them. But a car came, as the story goes, with angels to take him up to heaven. And this saint said, "Well, just a moment." He said, "What are the advantages of heaven?" And the angel said, "We've never been asked this question before. Everybody wants to go to heaven. But if you want to know, you have eternal springtime and beauty all around you. You get to mix with the gods. You get to have all your desires fulfilled easily," and so on. And the saint said, "Well, that's very interesting. But now I would like also to know, because I have seen that in this world there is always a disadvantage to everything, I would like to know what the disadvantages of heaven are." And the angel said, "Well, this is really past all belief. Nobody ever asks what the disadvantages of so much beauty are. But since you've asked me, I'm compelled to tell you that you can't remain there forever. You can only remain as long as your good karma allows you to. And when the time begins to approach that you have to return to earth, just like the leaves at autumn falling to the ground, so also your joys fall, and you begin to feel an intense pain at the thought of having to go back to this prison of this material world." And the saint said, "Stop right there." He said, "The disadvantages you've outlined are so colossal, I can't imagine anyone in his right mind wanting to go to heaven." And so he said, "Isn't there anything better?" And the angel said, "Well, This is your original, really an original. But indeed, there is a place beyond our region where there is no light, the lightless light, no dark, a darkless dark. It is where God and the great masters live. But to attain that state, you have to remain here in this world, because you have to work very hard. And that was the other disadvantage he outlined for heaven, that in heaven you can't make spiritual progress. It's here you have to come to make spiritual progress, unless you're very highly advanced already. But until you've attained liberation from earth, it's very difficult to make progress there. And so he said, for that you have to remain here. And the saint said, well, thank you very much, but I have absolutely no interest in going to heaven. I'd rather remain here. And so he did, and he remained for many years meditating. And when he left his body at death, he left it in complete freedom. So this is the goal that we should all really strive for. And a really spiritually inclined soul shouldn't even be interested in heaven, except as sort of a passing station to something much higher. Master asked the disciple, how are souls reborn on earth? After passing some time in the astral world, Yogananda replied, the length of their stay depending on their stored up good karma, the material desires in their subconscious become reawakened. They are then drawn back to earth or to some other planet in the material universe by the magnetic attraction of desire. At the time of physical conception, there is a flash of light in the ether. Souls in the other world that await physical rebirth, when the vibrations of that light are compatible to their own, rush towards it. Sometimes more than one soul enters a womb at the same time. Thus, twins are born. Disciple, are spiritual souls always born into spiritual families? The Master, like attracts like. That is the general rule. Many factors enter in, however. Timing, for example, and availability. For saintly souls, opportunities for reincarnation into highly evolved families are not many, for spiritual people often prefer not to marry and have children. There is, moreover, the question of individual karma with all its complexities. People are, besides, a mixture of many qualities. Sometimes it happens that a saint is born to criminal parents, if he shares with them a strong attraction, for instance, to peace. For couples desiring spiritual children, the Master continued, it is important that they keep their consciousness uplifted when coming together in physical union. For their vibrations at that moment will determine the quality of the flash of light in the astral world. A couple once told me they wanted a spiritual child and asked me to help them to attract such a soul to them. I showed them a photograph of a child who had died, and who, I felt intuitively, was karmically ready for rebirth. They felt drawn to the photograph. I then told them, remain sexually abstinent for the next 6 months and meditate daily. During meditation, concentrate on this photo and invite this being into your home. They did so, and at the end of that time, the wife conceived. This was the very soul that was born to them. Marvelous story. What sort of lessons are we supposed to learn in this great school of life? I've read books in which people have described dying temporarily and going into a light and realizing as they went into that light that they had to learn things, and that's why they had to learn more things, and that's why they had to come back to this world. And so the writer of at least one of these books was saying, this being evidently the case, the more we study, the more we read, the more we learn, the more ready we'll be to experience that high experience of light, that high plane of light. That's not the kind of learning intended. You could be a total ignoramus as far as the intellect goes. The important thing is what kind of lessons you've learned as a human being. You could be somebody illiterate and yet have learned the important lessons, which is how to be happy in yourself, how to get along with others, how to be helpful and not harmful in the things you do and in the ways you treat others, how to find peace when everybody else is agitated, how to be calm even when the world seems to be falling apart around you. All these are the lessons that help you to attain that state of centeredness from which you will really be able to rise to the highest levels of vibration after death. Master said the lesson of reincarnation is to neutralize the waves of likes and dislikes, of desire and aversion, by the expression of kindness, forgiveness, and compassion to all, and by steadfast contentment in the self. We must love others not for their human personalities, but because they are manifestations of God, who dwells equally in all. Another time he said, on the negative side of this equation, if you ridicule or condemn others, then at some time in this life or in some future life, you will have to undergo the same experiences as those of which you now disapprove so uncharitably. It's a very important thing to remember. Many people say, well, how can I remember my past lives? It seems as if we lived before, we should remember. Well, there are many stories of children, especially, who do remember. And these have come out much more in India or in other parts of the world where they believe in reincarnation than they do in the West, where people generally don't believe in reincarnation. But I know of several instances here in the West where people told me that as a child they did remember. One of them is a monk in SRF, Self-Realization Fellowship, who told me that when he was a boy of about 5, his mother brought some music home and started to play it on the piano. And he said, "Mother, I've heard that piece before." And she said, "No, you haven't. I just bought it. You've never heard it before." And he kept insisting. She said, "But then tell me, when? Did you hear it when I wasn't in the house? Did somebody come and bring it?" He said, "No, I heard it when I was an old man. Somebody took me up, they used to take me up on the roof, and I would listen to something not the same as this music, but sort of it made me think of it." And he spoke so seriously that his mother began to, you know, all children have their fantasies, but she began to get worried for his sanity. So she took him to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, "Well, you know, many children have these fantasies. Don't worry about it. He'll outgrow it." In fact, it was interesting because what he remembered was being Rameses II. And he hates having his photograph taken, which, you know, that Rameses II had statues of himself put all over the place. And he just got such a plethora of these statues, he got sick of the whole subject. And he would never let me take his photo, although I often tried to. So, the memory is there. However, for most people, well, you don't even remember the first year of your life, do you? Probably. Although there was an interesting story told me by another SRF monk years ago. He said that he told his mother one time about being in Amarillo. And his mother said, "Well, no, you've never been in Amarillo." And he insisted he had been. And she said, "No, I went there once when I was still carrying you, but you weren't born yet." And he described what he'd seen in such a way as to convince her that he had known. He'd been conscious and seeing through her eyes, or seeing with the eyes of the soul, whichever. But you see, we know more than we think we know. We understand more than we think we understand. We're wiser than we realize. And so, the memory of the past is something, for most people, somewhat buried, and it's a jolly good thing that it is. But there is a way to remember your past lives. In Patanjali, it gives the cue to that. It said, when you've reached perfection in your non-attachment to yourself, he calls it non-acceptance, and many people think of it as non-accepting gifts, but really it means non-acceptance of this body. When you can be that completely detached from your body in deep meditation, then you remember all your lives. So, a disciple asked, "Master, why can't I remember my past incarnations?" "It is better so, usually," replied the master with a humorous smile. "People would soon grow discouraged if they knew all the things they'd done wrong in the past. God gives them an opportunity to try again, without the false hypnosis that they are their mistakes. The less attached you are to the body," he continued, "especially during deep meditation, the more clearly you will remember your past lives and everything that you ever did in each one of them." But at the same time, one reason that these things are hidden from us is, as he said, so that we won't get discouraged. You do things too badly, and pretty soon it's hard to think that you can do them well. Death helps to clear the deck, at least as far as your conscious will is concerned, so that you can try again, imagining that you're not bound by those past that you're not bound by those past failures, and therefore you can exert your will in a more positive way. Sri Yukteswar used to say, "Forget the past. The past lives of all men are dark with many shames, but everything in future will improve if you are making the right spiritual effort now." Master said it wouldn't help most people to remember their past. Even in this lifetime, see how habit-bound many of them become. I call them psychological antiques. Everything they do is predictable. Even the melodies they whistle or sing are the same, year in, year out. And the older they grow, the more settled they become in all their ways of thinking, feeling, and behaving. Such people need the opportunity to forget what they've done and what they've been, and to start afresh. Only in a new beginning is there any hope of their making something better of themselves. And so, what we should do, rather, is take advantage of this principle of reincarnation and bring it down to the present. Make every day a new incarnation. There's that saying you've all read, "This day is the first day of the rest of your life." That's the way we should treat it, as if we were being born today with a completely new slate, a chance to do things that we've never done before, a chance to undo things that we've done wrong before, every day. In fact, Lahiri Mahasaya said that every breath is a new incarnation and can be made that, actually, literally, in a sense, not literally in the sense of being born in a new body, but literally in the sense of a new life, a new way of looking at things, a new way of doing things. Every time you inhale, I think that's probably the moment at which the horoscope should be drawn up, as you inhale, because that's when the energy starts to rise and you begin the involvement in this physical body. With inhalation, you accept life. With death, you exhale. They call it the death rattle. And so, every exhalation is a small death. Every inhalation is a new life. If you really want to overcome some habit, some fault, something that you've been working on and can't get rid of, using the breath can be helpful. I talked about it during the Kriya weekend, about using Kriya to overcome these things consciously. Here's another way you can do it. Master talked about it in relation to overcoming worry, but you can use it on all levels. He said, inhale and concentrate all your energy. Inhale deeply, concentrate all your energy at the point between the eyebrows, and just feel that you're burning away that worry thought in this case, but whatever other thought it might be that you have, that you're burning it away. Then exhale and keep the breath out and feel completely free. Just free yourself of all thoughts. Keep the breath out for as long as you can do so comfortably and dwell on the thought of freedom. When you begin to breathe again, try to dwell on some thought that is positive, that is worry-free, maybe a beautiful picnic you went on once, maybe a beautiful friend that you shared some experience with, something that is not at all associated with your worries. And you will find that with this simple technique, you can change your personality. You can change the habits of thought. Make your breath itself a process of reincarnation, and you'll find that you can have a new life even right now. Master said, as long as you enjoy living and acting in this dream of delusion, so long will you go on, for incarnation after incarnation, experiencing the pains and pleasures of this world and this body. The Bhagavad Gita describes it as a great wheel, endlessly turning. If, however, you desire strongly to get out, you must be released. Remember, freedom is your eternal destiny. And so we come to the important question here, working out karma. How do we escape this karmic maze where every desire seems to lead to many others? It's like that hydra-headed monster that every time one head was cut off, 9 more would grow. And how do we get out of this thing which seems to lead us ever deeper into bondage? Well, this is the subject of this chapter of Master's book. It all seems so complicated, Master, lamented a disciple. I can see that karma and reincarnation belong together, but when I think of all the actions one initiates in a single lifetime, and then multiply them by God knows how many more lifetimes, I am appalled. The interactions of cause and effect must be literally endless. So they are, agreed the Master, as long as one tries to work out his karma in the outer world. One desire leads to another, and that one to still others. Every desire must be fulfilled, every action brought to completion. Even trivial desires, pursued the disciple, that was me, in dismay. What about some little wish that I might have had once years ago for an ice cream cone? Even that, replied the Master emphatically, any energy that you put out, however slight, must return to you eventually. The disciple flung his hands up in despair. Then it all seems quite hopeless. As well might one try calming the waves of the ocean. It is a big job, I grant you, Yogananda said. Still, it isn't nearly so difficult as it looks. For ask yourself this, what is it that causes the waves to rise and fall in the first place? It's the wind. Without wind, the surface grows calm automatically. Similarly, when the storm of delusion abates in the mind, the waves of action and reaction subside automatically. So what you must do is still the waves of your mind by deep meditation, and then in meditation rid yourself of the consciousness of ego involvement. Once you cease seeing yourself as the causative agent, the waves of action and reaction may continue to rise and fall, but you yourself will no longer be bound by them. Would it be helpful, inquired the disciple, to stop acting altogether? This is something that I read, in fact, in a book of Indian philosophy written in France that said that it would seem then that the best thing you can do is simply not to act. Well, the Bhagavad Gita makes it very clear that nobody can escape action by not acting. This professor only showed his abysmal ignorance of the Indian philosophy when he said that. Master answered, just try it. He smiled. You'll see that it simply isn't possible to stop acting. Even the decision not to act would be an outward projection of your ego. It would therefore constitute action of a kind. I once met a man in Phoenix, Arizona, he continued, who was disheveled, his clothing a confusion of dirty rags. I said to him, why do you dress like that? You aren't so poor that you need to. I am a renunciate, the man declared proudly. On the contrary, I told him, you are attached all over again, but this time to disorder. The Bhagavad Gita teaches that no one can escape action, karma, in other words, by refraining from action. But the Gita also teaches an invaluable method for escaping karma. What it recommends is nishkam karma, desireless action, that is, action without desire for the fruits of action. If you act thus, you will gradually attain freedom from the bondage of karma. During activity, never feel that it is you who are acting. Act instead with the thought that God is the doer. Pray to Him, Lord, Thou art acting through me. Even when you make mistakes, make Him responsible for them. He likes that. Of course, you mustn't deliberately do wrong and then lay the blame on Him. But if you do your best but still fail, give your failure to Him. Cling to the thought that you are ever free in yourself. This is the way to final freedom in the Lord. Of course, other things are involved too. Devotion, meditation, divine grace, and so on. But as far as action is concerned, desireless action is the pathway to freedom. Somebody asked me an important question after the class yesterday. She said, but if I make God responsible for my actions, what about my own responsibility? And of course, that was a very important thing to bring out, because it would be absurd to treat somebody badly and the person gets all hurt and you say, oh, well, God did it. We have to take responsibility for our actions. That's what the law of karma and overcoming karma is all about. But then you give that which is yours because you've accepted it as yours, and you can only give something away that you own. So in that thought of responsibility, you offer that responsibility up to Him. It's a subtle distinction, but if you meditate on it, you'll understand it as Yogananda meant it. Never give up, or else you'll be lost, at least for that incarnation. This was a beautiful thing that Master said once. He said, if you, no matter how many times you fail, no matter how many times you fall, if you never give up, you can win, even at death. But if you give up, if you say, oh, I'm no good, if you say, well, delusion has beat me, then you'll have lost, at least for this incarnation, and more than likely for several incarnations thereafter. So never give up. Always cling to that thought that you are the child of God. Master said, even when indulging a bad habit because you can't help yourself, let your mind be constantly resistant to it. Never accept that bad habit as a definition of who you are within. And another time, one of the monks here was having a hard time struggling against temptation. I said to him one day, I don't ask that you overcome delusion. All I ask is that you resist it. We need a positive approach to sin. Otherwise, we get bogged down and discouraged by all that darkness that surrounds us, that wells up inside us, that we respond to like the notes on a piano to a sympathetic note struck outside it. We need to have this positive thought that I can win if we are really to win. This is why Master said that the greatest sin is to call oneself a sinner. He said, bad karmic tendencies can be overcome not by concentrating on them, but by developing their opposite good tendencies. Hence the importance of serving God. By service to Him through others, you automatically divert toward the development of good tendencies that energy which wants to take you in wrong, self-serving directions. Be ever busy for God. When you are not meditating, be active for Him. And when meditating, offer your mind up to Him in the same spirit of service with keen, alert attention. Keep the mind ever busy with God and with doing good for others. An idle mind is the workshop of the devil. Freedom is inside. We hear so much talk about political freedom, and so many people have started revolutions, fought in revolutions for the freedom to vote. That's not real freedom. As long as you're still bound by your ego to start with, the desires that accumulate around your ego for seconds, and on into that, people think that they're free if they do what they want, and they don't understand that in the very wanting they're already bound. That's why a saint said once, do not do what you like, and then you'll be able to do what you want. Or perhaps he put it this way, do not do what you want, and then you'll be able to do as you like. Because true freedom comes only once you have no desires at all, and then act simply as an instrument of God. And when you act in this way, then nothing can touch you. Ramakrishna told the story of a saint who was misapprehended for a robbery. And the saint just calmly went along with the police, who took him to the judge. And the judge asked him what he'd done. And he asked him if he was guilty or not guilty. And the saint said, well, I've done nothing of what I've been accused of. And the judge said, well, then what happened? And he said, well, God came to me in the form of these policemen and took me to prison. And then God has brought me here in the form of my jailers before your court. And God is now sitting up there to judge me, and I accept whatever God tells me through you. And he was just completely indifferent, because he knew that he had freedom wherever he was. It's sort of like Trailanga Swami, who used to go around without clothes because he'd renounced everything. And so the police, sometimes outraged, locked him up in prison. And later on they saw him walking around on the roof of the prison. Although his door was, the door of his cell was locked, still it didn't bother him. He could get out, and there he was walking around with, for more people to see than ever. But you will find that true freedom is what you have in your heart. Master said then, never let your mind be seduced by restlessness, through joking too much, too many distractions, and so on. Be deep. As soon as you succumb to restlessness, all the old troubles will begin their pull on the mind once again, sex, wine, and money. Of course, a little fun and laughter is good occasionally, but don't let light-mindedness possess you. I too like to laugh sometimes, as you know, but when I choose to be serious, nothing and no one can draw me out of my inner self. Be deep in everything you do. Even when laughing, don't lose your inner calmness. Be joyful inside, but always inwardly a little withdrawn. Be centered in the joy within. Dwell always in the self. Come down a little bit when you have to eat or talk or to do your work, then withdraw into the self again. Be calmly active and actively calm. That is the way of the yogi. It's interesting to hear people laugh and then hear how their laughter often will go beyond that sense of real happiness and joy inside. Every time you find that happening, any time you see your laughter, joking, talking, whatever it is, taking you out of yourself, stop it. You'll come away feeling unhappy that you did it. Always feel that whatever you do, this is where your center is. You're acting from that center, but always going back to that center. And above all, don't be emotional. You can see that things are to be changed. You can see that things haven't been done as well as they could be, and try to do them better. But the real demon, you might say, inside is the demon of emotions. Sometimes emotions feel good, sometimes they feel terrible. But even good emotions are still bondage. What we need to do is learn to calm these constant fluctuations of feeling in the heart. Only then, in that calmness, can we direct that feeling up toward an expansion of awareness, an expansion of love, an expansion of joy. Whereas when you're bound by emotions, you're always trapped in your little body, in your little heart's feelings. You can never expand beyond them. So watch your emotions. Never allow yourself to become emotional. And if you feel yourself being emotional, try to get calm again. One thing that you'll observe is that reason follows emotion. So that if your emotions are positive, you see all the reasons in the world why everything's great. If your emotions are negative, if you're feeling moody, you'll see all the reasons in the world why this world's a rotten place to live in. So don't trust your reason if your feelings are affected. But try rather to get away. I'll never forget one monk who had quite a temper. And this was at Mount Washington. Anyway, he got angry with somebody and strode away. And the man called out to him, "Don't go away mad, Jerry." Jerry said, "You want me to come back and go away madder?" It would be good whenever you find yourself upset to get off to yourself a little bit. Do some deep breathing. That'll help to calm the emotions. Try never to be emotional. That doesn't mean without feeling. But when you're calm, your feelings are going to be altogether different from when you allow them to jump up and down. When things go well, just tell yourself, "Well, maybe tomorrow they won't. I'm not going to commit myself wholly to this good feeling." When they go badly, okay, maybe tomorrow they'll be better. Always keep a little bit in reserve so that your rhythms are long, not short. And you'll find that then you can go through life calmly. Most people think, "Oh, yeah, but that's not living." But in fact, you'll be able to live much more deeply with much greater happiness if you do this. Be even-minded and cheerful. This is the motto of the yogi. Master said, objective conditions are always neutral. It is how you react to them that makes them appear sad or happy. Work on yourself, on your reactions to outward circumstances. This is the essence of yoga, to neutralize the waves of reaction in the heart. Be ever happy inside. You will never be able to change things outwardly in such a way as to make them ever pleasing to you. Change yourself. A good rule in life is to tell yourself simply, "What comes of itself, let it come."